Hudson Taylor in the Early Years, The Growth of the Soul, by Dr. and Mrs. Howard Taylor, printed 1911, with introduction by Mr. D.E. Hoist, General Director, China Inland Mission. To show forth thy loving kindness in the morning, and thy faithfulness every night. Preface. This book makes no claim to being anything but a true and grateful record of the Lord's dealings with our dear father in his early years. It is not fiction, though the form in which it has come to us is unusual, perhaps for a biography. It is the faithful story of the growth of a soul in the knowledge and love of God, drawn mainly from Mr. Taylor's own letters and recollections, which are freely quoted. It has been pondered and prayed over until it seems to have lived again in our hearts. Many a time as it has grown to completion, in spite of hindrances from without and within, that only the power of God has overcome, we have felt profoundly that the place whereon we stood was holy ground. Most gratefully do we thank all who have waited so patiently for this book, and to whose help in prayer we know it is largely due that it appears at length. May they find in its pages some fragrance of the life they loved, because it brought them nearer to God and strengthened them in seeking to live for His glory and the good of many. Praying that the cleansing of the precious blood of Christ may be upon all that is not of Him, we commit it now to His blessing, whose touch alone can turn the water into wine. Melbourne, September 22, 1911. Our indebtedness. We thankfully, very much, to wish acknowledge of all help that has come to us in compiling this record from sources other than Mr. Taylor's own writings and recollections. That his early letters have been preserved at all in an unbroken succession is due to the care of his mother, who filled 12 manuscript volumes with copies in whole or in part of his correspondency from the time his sister first went to school, and then to that dear sister herself, now the widow, of Mr. E. Broomhill. Grateful acknowledgement are due. The writers trust that they may have her forgiveness for giving her name the prominent position in this record that it necessarily occupies without her knowledge or consent. They can only plead that truth would have it so, well knowing that the best and sweetest her life has had to give have ever been held at the disposal of the Master. And there are others, too numerous to mention individually, who have helped in various ways to make this book what it is. For letters, photographs, and personal remembrances, the writers tender, heartfelt thanks. They desire also to record their gratitude to God that through the help of personal friends in England and in America, they have been enabled to complete the manuscript of this volume without expense of any kind to the China Inland Mission. In this respect, the narrative is in keeping with one important aspect of the life itself. For it was to Mr. Hudson Taylor a matter of constant thankfulness that he was enabled from first to last to refrain from drawing financial aid from the mission he founded, and so long sustained by faith and prayer. He was, on the contrary, a considerable donor to its funds, carrying out through all his connection with it the spirit of the last words quoted from him in these pages, that that spirit may be their own increasingly, in common with all who belong to and sustain the mission, is the earnest prayer of the writer, Howard and Geraldine Taylor. This book is in 6 parts with 42 chapters, being read by Peter John Parisis, also known as Brian Dean. None of my audios are copyrighted. Please feel free to make as many copies as you desire for the glory of God. Introduction. I feel it a great privilege to respond to the invitation to write a brief introduction to this, the first volume of the life of the founder of the China Inland Mission. In doing so, I venture, first, to draw attention to the latter part of its title, The Growth of the Soul. It will be found that this volume brings before the reader an account of the influences which, in various ways and in different degrees, contributed to the formation of the personal character of Mr. Hudson Taylor. At first sight, it might appear to some that to devote not less than half of the biography to one who did a great public work to a description of his preparation for that work, evidences some lack of the sense of due proportion. The authors were fully alive to this aspect of the subject, but as they studied and pondered over the materials at their disposal, it was impressed upon them with growing force that the experience and the career of Mr. Taylor furnished a notable illustration of the truth that when God raises up a man for special service, he first works in that man the principles which later on are, through his labors and influence, to be the means of widespread blessing to the church and to the world. Hence, this book has been written, not so much as a literary production, likely to be read with an interest such as is excited by the biography of a man of distinction in any walk of life, but with the earnest hope that it may be of practical service in illustrating and emphasizing the fact that, for the purpose of Christian work, personal character formed on truly Christian lines is the most important factor. Further, that the formation of such a character largely depends upon the choices made by the individual concerned in the opening years of life. The important part which the influences of heredity and early environment had in molding the personality of Mr. Taylor is amply brought out in this work. The narrative makes it quite clear, however, that these influences in themselves would have been inadequate without a moral response on his part to the claims of truth and duty as they presented themselves to him in his youth. Led by divine grace, when still a boy, to see in a crucified Redeemer the divinely provided answer to the problem of his guilt as a sinner, it was not long before he was further led in a very simple and direct way to accept the teaching of that Redeemer as his supreme rule of life. It may seem a truism to say that the conduct of the Christian is to be governed by the precepts of Christ, and yet how many there have been, and it is to be feared, are still, who, having in the first flush of the newborn faith and love taken the New Testament as the one and only standard of discipleship, have either broken down under the tests and difficulties of such a course, or have gradually yielded to the deadening influences of conventional standards taught and practiced around them. Through the grace of God, it was not so with Mr. Hudson Taylor. Having accepted the Holy Scriptures as his rule of life, it was not long before he was led into circumstances that, in various ways, severely tested his fidelity to them. And it becomes apparent in the biography that the manner in which he held on his way, in spite of great difficulties and the spirit in which he accepted not a little severe discipline, were, under God, the main factors in producing a strength and a quality of character, without which the work to which he was called could never have been accomplished. A good deal is written in the present day as to the need of living our lives and doing our work in a scientific manner. It is to be feared that much weakness and failure in Christian life and service may be traced to a lack of the scientific spirit in our treatment of the Holy Scriptures. We hear much, for instance, of the need of a fuller endowment of spiritual power for the Church and her representatives in the mission field. If the responsibilities involved by present opportunities are to be adequately met, it is sufficiently realized, however, in practice, that such endowment, the outstanding incident of which is recorded in the opening chapters of the Acts of the Apostles, was bestowed upon people who, during the preceding 3 years, whatever their faults and limitations, have counted the cost and had, without any reservation, responded in intention at all events to the conditions of discipleship laid down by their Lord. So much so that he was able at the close of that time to say to them, "Ye are they who have continued with me in my temptations, and I have appointed unto you a kingdom," just as the ministry of John the Baptist was antecedent and preparatory to that of our Lord, so the period of personal discipleship, involving as it did an unreserved placing of life and all it included at the disposal of the divine master, was essential and led up to Pentecost. Nor is there any other path at the present time. Outward circumstances alter with each succeeding age, bringing with them a corresponding modification in the external application of the principles and practice of our Lord. Similarly, these applications in the life of each individual will also have a character of its own. But the fact remains eternally true that the path of discipleship is the only road to spiritual power. I venture to dwell upon this point as illustrated in the life of Mr. Taylor, because experience shows that nothing is easier than, in the words of the prophet Isaiah, for the wine to become mixed with water. That is to say, for the essential teachings as to conduct given us by Christ and subsequently by his apostles and the epistles to be toned down and adulterated by the admixture of ideas and maxims, not only foreign to but repugnant to the spirit of Christianity. the great truth which is complementary to the foregoing, that it is only in union with Christ by the Holy Ghost that the Christian has the power to carry into practice the precepts of his Lord, also receives powerful illustration in this biography. A single-hearted, unreserved intention to follow the Lord, whilst essential, is by itself as fruitless as the efforts of, spelled S-I-S-Y-P-H-U-S. But it is also true that the inworking of divine grace will never be known in its victorious fullness where there is not such an intention. It is perhaps the highest tribute to the character of Mr. Hudson Taylor that it is a recollection of what he was, almost more than what he accomplished, which is most treasured by those who were privileged to know and work with him. He possessed qualities both of heart and mind not often found highly developed in the same individual. While it is no exaggeration to say he was literally consumed with a self-sacrificing zeal for the spread of the gospel, yet he was never hard or unsympathetic towards those who, through various causes, were unable to toil and to suffer as he did. On the contrary, his tenderness and sympathy endeared him to his brother and ever cheered those who were disheartened in the fight or laid aside by illness. His gracious, unassuming manner, his habitual kindness and gentle courteous, his tact and patience under opposition and ill treatment, combined to bestow a peculiar charm to his personality. Though gifted with more than ordinary powers both of thought and action, his true humility as well as his practical wisdom were evident by his readiness to confer with his brother, and by the deference with which he weighed the wishes and judgment even of those many years younger than himself. Never perhaps was there a man who, as he went on in life, was more free from the disastrous mistakes of despising the least of his brethren. There could be no doubt that to his habit of careful weighing the views of younger men was due the receptivity and elasticity which his mind retained to the end of his service. The fact that Dr. and Mrs. Howard Taylor are the authors of this book would seem in itself to render a reference to its workmanship superficial. It seems well, however, to mention that they have bestowed upon it far more than ordinary care and labor, such as a work of this kind would naturally call for, as the sense has deepened in their minds and in those of others that there were features in this biography which, if truthfully and adequately presented, were eminently calculated with the divine blessing to convey lessons of deep and permanent import both to the Christian community at large and also to individuals. Hence, not only have exceptional pains involving often much laborious research been taken to secure the strictest fidelity to truth and every detail of the record, but also no labor has been spared to present in their right proportion and their true light the guiding principles of this remarkable life. It is a sober truth to say that every page and even every sentence has been the subject of many earnest prayers for the divine blessing, and it may be added that the one desire of the authors has been that they may be the means of conveying a message of God which shall touch hearts and alter lives. D. E. Hoist, China Inland Mission, London, October 19, 1911. Part 1, Incidents, Home, and Early Years, 1776 to 1849. Chapter 1. As for me and my house. Lord, thou hast been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever thou hast formed the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, thou art God. O satisfy us early with thy mercy, that we may rejoice and be glad all our days. Let thy work appear unto thy servants, and thy glory unto their children. And let the beauty of the Lord our God be upon us, and establish thou the work of our hands upon us. Yea, the work of our hands establish thou it. Psalms 90. Chapter 1. As for me and my house. 1776 to 1786. It was Jane Taylor's wedding day, a wintry morning long ago in the North Country. The sun had not yet risen over Brierly Common, and in the snowy valley, Royston still lay in shadow, but in Staying Cross Ridge, the young stonemason was up betimes, making ready for his bride. Was there not water to carry from the well, and wood to prepare for the fire, as well as wheat to thresh and to take to the mill to provide for her first baking? Full of life and good spirits, a noted singer and extremely fond of dancing, Taylor had hardly given a serious thought to the step he was about to take. He had fallen in love with bright little Betty, one of the Johnsons of Royalston, in the final church of which he was a bell ringer and member of the choir. There he had heard the banns of marriage published with much satisfaction on three successive Sundays after the new year. And now the auspicious day had come, Thursday, the 1st of February, and all was ready for the festivities. There would be music and dancing, feasting and merrymaking, and he and Betty would be gayest of the gay. But beyond this, they anticipated little save the cozy fireside in the home that was to be. Now, however, as the young man went out into the frosty air to carry his sheaves to the barn, a new line of thought began to present itself. Was it the familiar cottage next door to his own as suggested it, the home of Joseph and Elizabeth Shaw, well known throughout the countryside? Was it the music of some hymn Dame Betty was singing as she plied her morning task? Not long ago, he could well remember, there had been more sighing than singing in this good woman's lot. Crippled by an acute attack of rheumatism, she had been confined to bed month after month in weariness and pain. But since that memorable day when all alone in the house she had trusted the Lord, as they put it, for immediate healing, great indeed had been the change. How astonishing her husband must have been when he came back a little later and found her not only up but sweeping the kitchen, as well and happy as could be. It had made much stir in the neighborhood, and Taylor, like everyone else, was at a loss to account for what had happened. Everyone, that is, except the Methodists, who seemed to think it simple and natural enough. But what credulity could surprise one in people of such extreme religious notions? Those notions seemed to haunt him this morning, however, strange as it might seem. For what had he to do with religion? He, the leader, rather than in all that was opposed to the revival that had invaded the neighborhood of late. Surely it was enough that Farmer Cooper and the Shaws had turned Methodist, bringing from Wakefield's preachers of the newfangled doctrines who terrified people with their earnestness about the wrath to come. Had not John Wesley himself appeared one Maplewell feast Monday, boldly addressing the crowds in the marketplace where the midsummer fair was going on? It was a courageous thing to do in that Yorkshire town, where betting the Methodists had become a favorite pastime for those of the rougher sort. But the white-haired preacher had so discoursed that day that all else had been forgotten, and he was allowed to pass unmolested to the Shaw's cottage on the ridge, there to rest till the cool of the day. Perhaps it was from his lips young Taylor had caught the words that returned to him now so persistently as he worked away in the barn. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Yes, he knew what it meant to serve the Lord. His neighbors lived that sort of life. But he was no narrow-minded Methodist. Besides, it was his wedding day. He was threshing wheat for Betty's homecoming. It was no time to be thinking of religion. As for me and my house. Yes, he was about to establish a new household that day. It was a serious step, a great responsibility. How careless had been his attitude hitherto. How unthinking. But now the words would not leave him. We will serve the Lord. Lord, hour after hour went by. The sun rose high over the hills, lighting the white-roofed village where the bride was waiting. Taylor was due there long before noon and had yet to don wedding apparel. But all was forgotten in this first great realization of eternal things. Alone upon his knees among the straw, the young stonemason was face to face with God. As for me, had taken on new meaning. The fact of personal responsibility to a living, though unseen being, love infinite and eternal, or justice as a consuming fire, had become real and monumentous as never before. It was the hour of the Spirit striving with the soul, the solemn hour when to yield is salvation, and there alone with God, James Taylor yielded. The love of Christ conquered and possessed him, and soon the new life from above found expression in the new determination. Yes, we will serve the Lord. Thus the critical moments of life come with little warning. Silently as the sunrise, often shedding divine illumination upon things unseen, all unexpectedly, one day, we see as we have never seen before. Duty becomes plain in the light of eternity. Then we have reached a turning point indeed, and everything depends upon the response of the soul to the claims and promises of God. Had young Taylor decided otherwise that winter morning How different this sequel must have been. It was the little beginning, the tiny spring, from which was to flow a blessing not for himself only and his house from generation to generation, but for an ever-widening circle in England, China, and throughout the Church of God. Such a moment may come for us today, fraught with far-reaching issues. What is our response to be? Speak, Lord, for thy servant heareth. Where the church bells ringing over the valley when James Taylor returned to consciousness of earthly things, it was almost noon. The wedding guests must be in consternation as to what had become of him. Never surely had the 2 miles of Royalston seemed so endless as when, fearing he could not be in time, he ran down the long hill from Staying Cross Ridge, a new man in a new world. Where the crossroads met in the heart of the village, he came in sight of the church at length, glancing apprehensively at the clock by the area window, where what was his surprise to find that it had come to a standstill, as if in sympathy with his dilemma. Possibly it might not yet be too late. Somewhere the bridal party was waiting. It was no moment for explanations. To church they went as speedily as possible. The victor asked no questions, unaware perhaps of the ruse whereby his bell ringers had saved the day for their favorite. The service duly proceeded. The register was signed in the vestry, and James Taylor and Betty Johnson were man and wife. Very interesting it was, more than 100 years later, to hunt up the old calf-bound volume and come upon the entry made that day, February 1st, 1776. Much of the writing was faded on the discolored page, but one signature stood out with startling clearness, vividly recalling the handwriting of another, who long after was to bear the bridegroom's name. There was the same familiar shapes of each carefully formed letter, the same firm, characteristic style, as though the quill had been guided by the very hand that so often wrote in recent years. Affectionately yours in Christ, James Hudson Taylor. And not the signature only is noteworthy in connection with this old-time story. The latter experiences of the stonemason and his wife reveal traits of character that also appear. But by the blessings of God and the great-grandson whose life we trace, there is the same singleness of purpose, strength of principle, love for the Lord Jesus Christ, and faithfulness in the service, a rich inheritance, bringing with it the blessing promised to the third and fourth generation. To begin with, there was no compromise about the James Taylor of long ago. Up to the hour of his wedding, he had been as far from religious impressions as the most thoughtless of his companions. Now, as they left the church, he did not hesitate to confess all that had taken place. Simply and earnestly, with his young wife on his arm, he explained that he had enlisted in the service of a new master. This meant, among other things, no dancing at his wedding or unseemly jollification. Hearing which, the bride exclaimed in dismay, "Surely I have not married one of those Methodists." But that was just what she had done, later as either of them expected it. But that is what she had done, little as either of them expected it. For the warm love and living faith of Staying Cross Society soon drew James Taylor into its membership. From the Shaws, Coopers, and others, he learned more of what it really means to serve the Lord. His voice and fiddle, formerly much in respect for rebels throughout the countryside, were now used only for his master, and before long he was gladly telling what great things had been done for his soul. And meanwhile, what about Betty? Well, she was far from happy. Her heart told her James was right, but she was most unwilling to share with him the reproach of Christ. So she grumbled and scolded and managed to make things generally uncomfortable. From the first day of their life together, James had commenced family prayers, but Betty refused to join him and busied herself ostentatiously about other things. At last, one evening, she was more trying than usual and more unreasonable in her reproaches. James bore it as long as he could. And then, before she knew what was happening, Betty found herself lifted in his strong arms and carried to the room upstairs. There he knelt down, and keeping her still beside him, poured out all his sorrow and concern in prayer. She had not realized before now how much he cared. His earnestness solemnized and impressed her, and though she would not show it, she began to be troubled by a sense of sin. All next day her distress deepened. How willingly, then, would she had been as her husband's was. In the evening, the Bible was brought out as usual, and Betty was glad enough to listen. The prayer that followed seemed just what she was needing, and that night, while James was still on his knees, she entered into peace with God. Thus, at the outset of their married life, these two were united in the best of ways, and as the years went on, they became increasingly happy and helpers of one another's faith. It was a wonderful movement of the Spirit of God into which James Taylor and his wife were thus introduced in a remote corner of Yorkshire. All over Great Britain and Ireland, similar conversions were taking place. Breaking in upon the darkness of the 18th century, a glorious revival swept the land, saving it from threatened destruction. In the established church, dead though it was for the most part, mighty men of God were raised up. Whitfield, the Wesleys, Grimshaw, Rowlands, Burridge, and many others, with whom wrought a multitude of unleavened evangelists, proclaiming in humble spheres the saving grace of God. How terrible was the state of things before this work began, it is hard for us now to realize. In town and country alike, people were abandoned to vice and irreligious, well-nigh incredibly, in our day. For the most part, as the churchman suddenly records, in a state of heathen or worse than heathen ignorance, the immorality of the wealthiest classes and the indifferences of the clergy were no less menacing than the rudeness of the peasantry and the brutality of the town populace. The prevalence of drunkenness, the growth of impiety, and the general deadness to religion. Men who, in the face of such conditions with the pulpits of the land closed against them, fearlessly took their stand for God and righteousness, stormed the strongholds of Satan, plucked thousands like brands from the burning, and altered the character of that age, needed an endowment of the Holy Spirit no less mighty than that of the first evangelists who turned the world upside down. Like them, too, they had to be prepared to die daily, that they might fill up that which was lacking of the afflictions of Christ. For only through lives laid down could such regenerating work be done, and not the leaders only, men whose names are honored now the wide world over. The strength of the revival lay in the great host of men and women, unknown to fame, who everywhere rejoiced to share their apostolic labor, sufferings, and success. Amongst these came to be numbered James and Betty Taylor in a peculiar dark and needy corner of the dark and needy England of those days. And who shall say that the courage, steadfastness, dependency upon God developed by the conditions they had to face do not lie at the foundation of much that is recorded in this book? A serious accident some years after his marriage obliged James Taylor to face the fact that he must give up his work as a stonemason and find other means of supporting his family. It was a gloomy outlook, for there were fewer ways of earning a livelihood in those days than at present, and country occupations to which he was accustomed were all beyond his strength. The only course open to him was to leave the little home on Staying Cross Ridge and seek in some manufacturing center the lighter employment factory or workshop might afford. Barnsley was the nearest place of the kind, a notoriously wicked mining town, just across the valley of the Darney. Drunkenness, lasciviousness, and gambling, the three great sins of the nation, were there especially rife, and scarcely any people, William Brimswell tells us, raged against the Methodists or persecuted them with such ferocity as the people of Barnsley. The churches were deserted and the alehouses overflowing, with what results may be judged from notices such as the following, which were only too common. Drunk, a penny. Dead drunk, 2 pence. Clean straw for nothing. It must have been hard for James and Betty Taylor to bring their children to the atmosphere of a place like this, but when employment was offered him in the linen warehouse of Joseph Beckett, a local magistrate, at a wage of 13 shillings and 6 pence weekly, they could no longer hesitate. At the top of Old Mill Lane, on the outskirts of the town, stood a four-room cottage, from which might be seen the wooded hills of their childhood. It was a busy corner, for the crossroads met at their door, and the London coach, coming up from the marketplace, paused there to adjust its brakes before turning down the steep lane on its way to Wakefield and Leeds. Travelers were constantly passing on the Sheffield Highway, and so frequent were the inquiries as to various destinations that the occupants of the mansion opposite went to considerable expense to settle the questions once and for all. The obelisk he erected is useful still, with its modern lamps and full directions, and when the sun is settling, its shadow falls upon the site once occupied by James Taylor's modest dwelling. Here, then, the new arrival settled, finding it a great change from their old surroundings. Living was more expensive than in the country, and though the father was earning what was then good wages, it was far from easy to make both ends meet. Besides rent and taxes, there were 2 sons and 3 little daughters to provide for, and all they had to live on was a small sum of 12 shillings a week. And what of the remainder of the father's earnings, the extra 1 6 pence he received weekly? Was it reserved for special comforts, tobacco, tea, or snuff? Was it set aside for winter clothing or against a rainy day? No, it was given, sacrificed rather, for love of one dearer to them than their children, more considered than themselves. Poor as they were in the world's goods, they had learned the secret of being rich towards God. In Betty's kitchen stood a corner cupboard containing a special cup, into which, as James brought home his earnings, 1 shilling and 6 pence always found their way. This was consecrated money, never to be touched save for the support of God's cause and the relief of the poor. Thus, they always had something ready for the master's use, and the remainder of their little income proved sufficient and unfailing, because the blessing of God rested on it. It was the old story of the widow's meal and oil, for the Lord will be no man's debtor. Oh, that cup in the corner cupboard, that faithful giving of a ninth of everything, a tenth, could not suffice them. To the Lord, how much it explains of the blessing in the lives of their children's children. The loss of Christian fellowship was the change they felt most keenly during those early days in Barnsley. The beautiful church of St. Mary's, a few steps from their door, offered no substitute for the meetings in Betty Shire's cottage, and of helpful spiritual ministry there seems to have been none. True, the Friends had a meeting house a mile or two from the town, and the Independents were building on a Quirlwell Hill, the first nonconformist place of worship, but there was little to choose between church and chapel in those days. Deadness and indifference paralyzed both alike, so that, as Bishop Well puts it, they seemed at last agreed on one point, to let the devil alone and do nothing for hearts or souls. This state of things became a heavy burden on the new arrivals, and they longed unspeakably for some voice to tell the glad tidings that had set them free. But preachers rarely came from more favored localities, and when they did, it was a sorry welcome they found in Barnsley. Year in and year out, James Taylor and his family were distressed to see the Sabbath profaned and all kinds of brutal, fiercest, and lascivious games practiced. It was little they could do to stem the torrent of iniquity, but it was better than nothing, and they could not hold their peace. And so it came to pass that Betty's kitchen was swept and garnished, and a few neighbors gathered in for informal meetings. The singing, no doubt, was an attraction, and both James and his wife were among the people that do know their God, and so can be a help to others. Some evidently received blessing, for in a time a class was formed which met regularly in the little cottage. Eventually a Methodist society was fully organized, and James Taylor appointed as the first class leader and local preacher in Barnsley. Long before this, however, he had been privileged to make full proof of his ministry in true apostolic ways. Down on the old bridge and in the marketplace, he had been in danger of his life once and again while preaching in the open air. Pelted with stones and refuse, struck down and dragged through the mire, he had been rescued at the last minute, only to preach again. Returning from a meeting on one occasion, he was accosted by a couple of men who appeared to be friendly. Engaged in conversation with one of them, he did not notice the movement of the other, who suddenly rubbed into his eyes a mixture of pounded glass and mud, calculated to blind him. For life, sightless and in desperate pain, Taylor was wholly at their mercy, and there is no knowing what might have happened had not Joseph Beckett coming down Church Street at the time, hastened to his assistance. Seeing the magistrate, the ruffians made off, but not before Mr. Beckett had recognized one of them, a professed infidel and no friend to the Methodists in Barnsley. Poor Taylor was taken home in great suffering, and it was fully 3 months before he could return to work again. His employer urged him to take out a summons, having himself witnessed the occurrence, but James would not hear of it. No, he said, the Lord is well able to deal with them. I would rather leave it in his hands. This did not satisfy the magistrate, however, who decided to carry the prosecution through on his own account. In the witness box, the culprit denied the charge, calling upon God to strike him blind if he had had anything to do with the outrage. Shortly after, all Barnsley knew that he had lost his sight. For the rest of his life, he had to be led by a dog through the familiar streets and ultimately sunk into extreme poverty. His accomplice also was obliged to confess that nothing ever prospered with him from the time of their cruel attack upon James Taylor. Such experiences, in common with others of a less serious character, afforded abundant opportunity for putting into practice the teachings of the Sermon on the Mount, opportunities not lost upon James Taylor and his fellow Methodists. It was an eloquent sermon he preached in Eastgate, for example, when an angry woman ran after him, frying pan in hand. She had seen the good man go by wearing a light-colored overcoat and thought it was an excellent opportunity of provoking him into a quarrel. Coming up behind, she vigorously rubbed the greasy, sooty utensil all over the back of his tidy garment, using her tongue, meanwhile, to the amusement of onlookers. But it was her turn to be discomforted when Taylor turned round with a smile, suggesting that if it afforded her satisfaction, she might grease the front as well. Covered with confusion, the woman retired, but the incident was not easily forgotten. It is said that on his deathbed, the infidel above mentioned sent for the man who he had injured, hoping to find comfort in his prayers. But eager as he was to help his former enemy, Hudson Taylor could not pray. He tried and tried again, but his cry seemed to return from an unanswered heaven. The solemn words then came to mind, "He that being often reproved hardeneth his neck shall suddenly be cut off, and that without remedy." To see an unrepentant soul pass into eternity was far more terrible to him than all the persecutions he had endured. For none of these things moved him. He found that it was a safe thing and a blessed to trust in the living God. The little home at the top of Old Bill Lane was increasingly happy and a center of blessing to others. Dame Betty, in spite of her household cares, found time to be useful as a class leader among the women. Their children grew up a joy and comfort to them, and in all that makes for true prosperity, they were enriched of God. Attempts to do them harm were so manifestly overruled that they helped rather than hindered their influence. And one is not surprised to learn that as time went on, they, with others of these early Methodists, by their meekness, uprightness, and consistent conduct, lived down opposition and took their place amongst the most respected inhabitants of the town. A light change was becoming apparent all over England. The close of the century that overwhelmed the land of the Votar with the unspeakable horrors of the French Revolution witnessed in the home of Whitefield and the Great Revival a peaceful transformation of national life and character. Long surviving his own generation, Wesley, at 80 years of age, could look out upon a revived and purified church leading the people's progress towards righteousness, liberty, and enlightenment, and welcome the dawning of the day of the modern missions that was to extend these blessings to a waiting world. His evangelistic journeys were now religious ovations, and he himself, the best known man in England, was honored and beloved for his work's sake, where so long he had been hated and despised. This was the period of his long-expected visit to Barnsley, the first and only recorded occasion of his preaching there. Great must have been the joy of James Taylor and his friends as they prepared to welcome their father in the faith. In numbers, the little society had not made much progress, for those had been difficult years, but in the knowledge of God and the influence of those around them, great headway had been won. They were able to look forward to the coming of the great evangelist without anxiety as to the reception that awaited him, and could even arrange with the landlord of the Old White Bear to make use of his spacious yard near the marketplace for an open-air meeting. Wesley came to them from Epworth, the home of his childhood, having recently celebrated his 83rd birthday. How unusual was the vigor he enjoyed, both of mind and body, may be judged from the following entry in his journal, penned 2 days before he reached Barnsley. Wednesday, June 28, 1786. I am a wonder to myself. It is now 12 years since I have felt any special sensation as weariness. I am never tired, such is the goodness of God, either with writing, preaching, or traveling. Thursday night was spent at Doncaster, and from thence he drove over the Hicklestons Hills and through the lovely valley of the Darney. Somewhere in the road, no doubt, the Barnsley friends would meet him, but it is hardly likely that James and Betty Taylor were among their number. For them, the morning hours would be busy, as there was to be the honor of entertaining the distinguished guest. Picture then the preparation in the little cottage that was to shelter John Wesley that night beneath its roof. Thousands of homes he had visited in which his chamber may have been finer and the table spread before him more ample in its provision. But it is doubtful whether he ever met a warmer welcome or more genuine love for himself and for his master. Methodism has no truer friends than this worthy couple, writes a well-known citizen of Barnsley. Their devotion increased with their difficulties. Persecution did not sharpen the edge of their attachment to Wesley and his cause. Persecution did but sharpen the edge of their attachment to Wesley and his cause. Their home seems to have been the chief resort of preachers who came from Wakefield and other places. What more fitting than that they should entertain the great evangelist himself and so receive a distinction not soon to be forgotten. That June day of 120 years ago has left its mark in Barnsley. The arrival and progress of Mr. Westwood through the crowded streets, the scene in the yard of the old White Bear with its stone stairway from which his discourse was delivered, the excitement and eager attention of the multitude, the appearance of the venerable speaker, his earnestness and power in setting forth eternal things, these and many other recollections are treasured on the library shelves of that Yorkshire town and in the warm hearts of its people. But our present concern is chiefly with the close of the day, when the great meeting over, the preacher was escorted to the home of his humble friends. It had been a notable address, lengthened and increasingly earnest, as the response of the audience was evident, and now the simple meal was welcome, and fellowship of the inner circle around Dame Betty's hearth. Interested in all that concerned them, Wesley would soon make his sympathy felt, winning the hearts of his children and the confidence of the older people. He may even have heard the story of James Taylor's conversion on his wedding day and the consolation of the bride on learning that she had actually married one of those Methodists. And then as twilight deepened, one can well imagine the earnestness with which he would seek to strengthen and encourage those he might never meet on life's pilgrimage again. Remember, we can almost hear him say, remember, you have nothing to do to compare in importance with saving souls. Therefore, spend and be spent in this work. Otherwise, it is not your business to preach so many times a week or to take care of this or that society, but simply to save as many souls as you can, to bring as many sinners as you possibly can to repentance, and with all your power to build them up in that holiness without which no man can see the Lord. Only through unwearied labor and perseverance can we really be free from the blood of all men. Go into every house and teach everyone therein, young and old, if they belong to us, to be Christians inwardly and outwardly. Make every particular plain to their understanding. Fix it in their memory, write it on their hearts. In order to do this, there must be line upon line, precept upon precept. I remember to have heard my father say to my mother, how could you have the patience to tell that child the same thing 20 times over? Why, she answered, if I had told him but 19 times, I should have lost all my labor. What patience indeed, what love, what knowledge is requisite for this? Oh, why are we not more holy? He would exclaim with loving insistency. Why do we not live in eternity, walk with God all the day long? Why are we not all devoted to God, breathing the whole spirit of missionaries? Alas, we are too much enthusiasts, looking for the end without faithfully using the means. Do we rise at 4 or even 5 in the morning to be alone with God? Do we fast once a week, once a month? Do we even know the obligation and benefit of it? Do we recommend the 5 o'clock hour for private prayer at the close of the day? Do we observe it? Do we not find that any time is no time? Oh, let us stir up the gift of God that is in us. Let us no more sleep as do others. Let us take heed to the ministry that we have received in the Lord, that we fulfill it. Whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with thy might. In some such helpful intercourse, the hours would fly, until candles had to be lighted, and the guest who was to depart on the morrow, escorted to his chamber under the cottage eaves, was it that night, beneath James Taylor's roof, he penned the entry in his journal that seemed so pertinent to the story of his book? Friday, June 30th, 1786. I turned aside to Barnsley, formerly famous for all manner of wickedness. They were then ready to tear any Methodist preacher in pieces. Not a dog wagged its tongue. I preached near the marketplace to a very large congregation, and I believe the truth sank into many hearts. They seemed to drink in every word. Surely, God will have a people in this place.